The sergeant led Freeman and me out to the hall. He and his men marched us into a much larger room. It was an auditorium with a well-shaped gallery that could easily hold 200 people. The sergeant had Freeman and me sit on two chairs placed on the stage at the bottom of the room. Beside our chairs was a podium with a carving of an eagle carrying arrows. The eagle was the emblem of the Linear Committee, the executive branch of the UA government. Freeman and I sat silently as men and women entered the auditorium and filled the gallery. I recognized most of these people, and many of them seemed to recognize me. The group included high-ranking officers, such as Admiral Alden Brocious of the Central Cygnus Fleet and General Alexander Smith of the Air Force, who had been head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff when the Separatists attacked Earth. Both of them had been closely allied with the late Admiral Bryce Kleiber, the officer who'd had me created and overseen much of my career. In all, approximately 50 people came in to observe or interrogate Freeman and me.
They don't know what to do with this.
William Grace, a member of the Linear Committee at the outset of the war, approached the stage. He stopped to examine Freeman and me, then stepped behind the podium.
Men and women of the Security Council, good afternoon. For the record, on this, the third day of October 2512, we are convening an emergency meeting of the Unified Authority Security Council. Will the visitors please rise?
Freeman and I got to our feet.
Please identify yourselves.
Raymond Freeman.
Are you injured, Mr. Freeman?
We had an accident.
Do you require medical assistance?
No.
I see that you are a freelance contractor who has worked with the UA military on several occasions, is this correct?
Grace had to have read that from an official dossier. Freeman nodded.
According to this record, you have provided valuable services to the UA Navy in the past.
Freeman said nothing. Grace moved on to me.
And you? Please identify yourself.
Colonel Wason Harris.
Colonel Harris, my records show that you were raised in Unified Authority Orphanage number 553. Is this correct?
UAO number 553. That is correct, sir.
According to one of your former commanding officers, you are aware of your nature.
If you are asking whether or not I know that I am a military clone, I am aware that I am a clone.
And you are a Liberator-class clone, is that correct? You are, as far as you know, the last of your kind.
Yes, sir.
Are you the same Wason Harris who survived the battle on Little Man? Are you one of the Little Man Seven?
Yes, sir.
And you testified about that battle before the House of Representatives?
Yes, sir.
You were reported as killed in action at Ravenwood Outpost.
That is correct, sir.
But you were not killed there.
No, sir.
According to your military record, you were promoted to the rank of colonel in the Unified Authority Marines by Admiral Che Huang. Is that correct?
That is correct, sir.
Welcome home, Colonel Harris. It is a distinct pleasure to welcome back a war hero like you.
I'm afraid I am confused, sir.
Not expecting a hero's welcome?
I'm not sure I deserve one.
We know more about you than you might think. After the Mogats defeated the Earth fleet, we found a video record among the late Admiral Huang's possessions. The record included conversations you had with Huang about infiltrating the Mogat fleet.
I didn't know he kept a record of that.
For his memoirs, Huang saw himself as a man of destiny.
I see.
We also have received another account of your actions on the enemy ship. We know, for instance, that you were captured while transmitting Mogat battle plans to Huang. How did you get onto their ship?
Everybody knew that the Mogats were going to attack New Columbia. I flew into safe harbor after the Planetary Authority evacuated the city. When the Mogats arrived, I located one of their commando teams and stowed away aboard their transport.
As I understand it, you warned Admiral Huang that the Mogats planned to attack New Tuscany. That was how he was able to rout their fleet.
I believe that is correct.
Why have you returned to Earth, Colonel Harris?
William Grace, they called him Wild Bill Grace in the media, was a short, chubby man. He must have been 5'3", or maybe even shorter. He weighed a good 300 pounds. He was bald from his forehead to his crown, with a bushy ring of gray hair running between his ears.
Yoshi Yamashiro, the governor of Shin Nippon, sent me. He wants to form an alliance with the Unified Authority and the Confederate Arms.
Are you working for the Japanese?
No, sir. Yamashiro found us stranded in space. He rescued us and brought us here, and he asked me to deliver the message that he wanted to make an alliance.
What does Governor Yamashiro have in mind?
The Mogats declared war on Kato and the Japanese.
Kato was the Confederate Arms Treaty Organization.
We were aware of their split.
That surprised me. Without the broadcast network, Earth should have been completely cut off. Then something that I should have noted from the start occurred to me. Admiral Brocious of the Central Cygnus Fleet was sitting in the gallery. He should have been marooned 60,000 light-years away with the ships of his fleet. How could he have come for this meeting?
The Japanese escaped with 4 battleships. Is that correct, Colonel?
Yes, sir. 4 ships.
It wasn't only Admiral Brocious. As I looked into the gallery, I started noticing other officers. Having served under Brocious, I spotted him before I saw the others, but they were there. I saw a commander whom I remembered from my days with the Scutum Crux fleet.
How did you know that the Japanese had 4 ships, sir?
We know a great deal about the battle between Atkins' believers and the Confederate arms. The Unified Authority is not as stranded as you might think, Colonel Harris.
After the meeting, Freeman and I were escorted to a barracks, where we were each given our own room. The agency in charge of us did not post guards outside our doors, though they probably had people watching us from nearby buildings. The base commander gave Freeman and me our own electronic identity cards for use as keys to get in and out of the facilities. By all appearances, we could come and go as we pleased. My room must have been wired for sound and video, but I did not bother to check. Having nothing to hide, I had no reason to look for surveillance devices. They could watch me to their heart's content. I didn't mind. Freeman undoubtedly did check his room for microphones and cameras. He left nothing to chance. He and I ate a very quiet dinner that first evening in the officers' mess, then returned to our rooms. The next morning, we met at 0700 and had breakfast.
It's like they never had a war.
He neither answered nor nodded. Freeman must have believed they were watching us. Fiercely independent, he did not tolerate intrusions as calmly as I. At 0900, our unnamed driver showed up at the barracks and took us into town. He drove the same black sedan, or possibly a reasonable facsimile. The more I saw of Washington, D.C., the more confused I became. It was not the city under siege that I had imagined. The streets showed no telltale signs of battle. I saw no burned buildings on vacant lots. More importantly, Washington, D.C. society still seemed intact. In the distance, I saw the Capitol, a 20-story building topped off with a 300-foot marble dome. It was the largest building on the face of the earth, with 24,000 miles of corridors. We did not drive to the Capitol, however, nor did the driver pull into the Pentagon, a monolithic cube that, despite the geometric significance of its name, had only 4 sides. Instead, our driver took us into the heart of Washington, D.C., where the real deals were crafted. Skyscrapers filled with law offices and banking operations lined the road. Our driver passed the ostentatious 30 and 40-story structures, then pulled into a 5-story affair. Civilian guards met us as we entered the underground garage. We exited the car and went to the elevator. 4 security men with holsters and pistols met us when the elevator doors slid open. They accompanied a young woman who identified herself as William Grace's secretary.
Mr. Freeman, Colonel Harris, if you would please follow me.
The secretary led Freeman and me into a large conference room, and I froze in mid-stride. Wild Bill Grace and Gordon Hughes stood to greet me. Grace, the senior member of the Linear Committee, I had expected to see. Hughes, the chairman of the Confederate Arms Treaty Organization, I had not. Hughes had once been the speaker in the UA House of Representatives. He abandoned the Republic at the beginning of the war and became the most powerful politician in the Confederate arms. Now he and Grace stood, casually chatting like old friends. Grace and Hughes came to the door to shake hands with Freeman and me. They seemed entirely at ease with each other, as if the war had never taken place.
Colonel Harris, this is a distinct pleasure. You're surprised to see me here.
Hell yes.
Quite understandable.
We have a lot to discuss. Perhaps we should get started.
It was a small meeting, 10 people sitting around a conference table discussing the future of the galaxy. Gordon Hughes came with a female secretary and 2 plainclothesmen. William Grace brought General Smith from the UA Air Force and 2 aides. The only other people in the room were Freeman and me and a couple of guards.
I might as well begin by explaining what you're doing here. Colonel Harris, the Mogat attack on the Mars broadcast discs shut down the broadcast network, but that does not mean it shut down all pan-galactic travel.
The scientific fleet.
The scientific fleet. We have nearly 2,000 self-broadcasting ships on Earth and in the field. They may not be combat ready, but they are able to travel. You are not the only one who forgot about the civilian fleet. From what we can tell, the Mogats seem to have entirely forgotten about our civil ships as well.
We certainly overlooked them. Using our exploration ships, we have been able to locate all 18 of our Navy fleets. Sending supplies out is not as convenient as it used to be, but we have managed to reestablish supply lines.
Gordon here was the one who told us what you did to help fight the Mogats. Once we discovered your identity, the chairman told us about all your exploits on that Mogat ship.
Yoshi isn't the only one who realizes that we need an alliance. The Mogats launched an attack on us within hours of the invasion.
Judging by the way Gordon Hughes and William Gray spoke, Confederate Arms' participation in the attack on the Earth fleet was still a sensitive topic. Grace referred to the enemy fleet as the Mogat fleet, avoiding any mention of Confederate Arms' involvement. For his part, Hughes seemed just as anxious to pretend the Mogats had launched the attacks on their own. Hughes and Grace acted like old friends, just a couple of businessmen planning their next big merger.
We sent an ambassador to Earth to ask if we could sign an accord with the Unified Authority, ending our hostilities. That's not quite as dramatic as sending back a war hero bearing an olive branch and a flag of truce, but Yoshi and I had the same goal in mind.
Yamashiro and his four-boat Shin Nippon Navy gave Freeman and me 1 week to enter Washington, D.C., locate whoever was in charge, if anyone was in charge, and propose an alliance. At the end of 1 week, he would fly past Earth and scan for our signal. If he received the wrong signal, or there was no signal at all, he would fly past and never return. He did not offer to search for us. We were not from his clan. As it turned out, we didn't need a week to pass on Yamashiro's invitation. Had he returned within 24 hours of dropping us off, we would have had more than enough time. By lunch that next day, both William Grace, chief member of the Linear Committee, and Gordon Hughes, chairman of Cato, had already agreed to meet with Yamashiro.
Next week?
I explained that I would not be able to signal the Sakura right away.
That's Yoshi. He's always so darn cautious.
At one point during their conversation, William Grace asked me if I had any questions about the alliance between the Confederate Arms and the Unified Authority.
What about war criminals?
Criminals? What do you mean by war criminals?
The Confederate Arms sent terrorists into Unified Authority territory to attack civilian targets. What about William the Butcher Patel? What about...
Ah, William Patel. If I'm not mistaken, you were in Safe Harbor when he set off a bomb.
It wasn't just a bomb. He destroyed an entire city block.
Oh, those were desperate times. We were at war, Harris. I don't suppose we shall ever invite Patel to the capital for tea. But in light of our new arrangement with the Confederate Arms, I think that a pardon is in order.
I see. What about Tom Halverson? Are you going to pardon him for sinking the entire Earth fleet?
Halverson was a UA admiral who had defected to the Confederate Arms. He'd led and commanded the fleet that attacked Earth.
I suppose we will extend full amnesty to Tom. We can't very well arrest the man commanding our combined fleet.
Commanding the fleet?
Certainly. Halverson is the commander of the Confederate Arms Navy. Chairman Hughes has made it very clear that he will not trust anyone but Halverson to command his self-broadcasting fleet.
We broke for lunch. Freeman and I ate downstairs in a cafeteria with our driver and some guards, while the politicians and officers ate upstairs.
I'm going to walk.
Freeman did not want to leave his life in Grace's hands, and maybe he had the right idea. Now that we had delivered Yamashiro's message, neither William Grace nor Gordon Hughes showed interest in Freeman or me. We returned to the same conference room and sat ignored as all of the big shots discussed the benefits of adding Shin Nippon's four battleships to their navy. As the conversation shot back and forth, I noticed Freeman sneak a furtive glance at the door. He climbed out of his chair. The conversation froze, and everyone turned to look at him. Looking profoundly nervous, a guard approached Freeman, his hand on the grip of his pistol.
I need to go to the restroom.
Grace nodded to the guards.
Perhaps you could show Mr. Freeman the way.
Freeman left with the guard. As they left, I already knew that I would not see Ray Freeman again for some time to come. The meeting broke up a few minutes after that. Wild Bill Grace shook my hand and left with his entourage. Gordon Hughes left with his entourage. My driver came to the room.
Shouldn't we wait for Freeman?
That might take a little while.
Is he sick or something?
No.
I had a pretty good idea about what was next on the agenda for me. In the next day or two, the Marines would recall me to active duty. As far as Wild Bill and his UA generals were concerned, they owned me. I was a clone, created by the state. They had just as much right to recall me as they would to recommission a tank or an old battleship.
Should we go check on your friend?
Sure. Where shall we look?
He went to the can.
You think so?
No.
He isn't there.
With cat-like speed, the man sprinted from the room. He knew that he did not have to worry about me. I was military. I would be here when he got back. I had no place to go. I sat at the table and waited. About 3 minutes later, the driver returned, an angry look on his face.
Okay, smart guy, so where did your pal go?
How should I know that? You've seen him. You think he asked me for permission?
Nah, I guess not.
You've had us under surveillance. Where do you think he went?
Who says we had you under surveillance?
Don't be an ass. You're from intelligence, right?
Let's just say I'll have some buddies looking for your friend.
You better call them off.
You think we're scared of Freeman?
If you're smart, Freeman scares you. What happened to the guy who walked into the bathroom?
We found him on the stairs.
Dead?
Unconscious. He's got a concussion and a broken wrist.
So Ray took it easy on the guy. Let's see. He was unarmed, and he took out an armed agent. Now you have an agent with a concussion, and Freeman has a gun. Yes, I'd be scared of Freeman if I were you.
We'll find him. He's a 7-foot black man. How hard can he be to locate?
So are you with Central Intelligence?
Naval Intelligence.
You should have a file on Freeman.
We do.
I suggest you read it.
You think so?
Take me back to the base.
What makes you think I haven't read his file?
If you'd read the file, you wouldn't go after him. He's a freelance contractor, but he works exclusively for the Unified Authority. He's not going to the MOGATs. He doesn't like them. The only thing you're going to accomplish by sending agents after Freeman is losing men.
Yeah? What, you think he's a pretty tough guy?
You have the files.
Okay, hotshot. $50 says that we'll have Freeman back in his room by supper.
$50? That's a scared man's bet.
You want to bet $100? Let's bet $100!
I did not actually have any money.
No.
Now who sounds nervous? Tell you what, I think you're good for it. I'll spot you the money. If I win, you can owe me the 50.
So spot me 100.
Fine, we'll make it 100. You can owe me the 100 on credit. I may not have checked your friend's file, but I've checked yours, pal. You got a lot of back pay coming.
Done.
As I entered the barracks, it occurred to me that I was just about back in uniform. Maybe I should have run with Freeman. That said, there was something strangely comfortable about returning to the service. Maybe I was still euphoric about escaping farming, Neo-Baptists, and Little Man. But maybe it was because the Unified Authority Marine Corps was the only place where I fit in. Entering my room, I spotted a package that someone had left on my bed. The note on the outside of the package said it was from Admiral Alden Brocious. Inside the package, I found general issue essentials, a leather toiletry kit with the emblem of the Unified Authority Marines embossed on it, and a pair of shades, glasses designed for viewing the media link. Before the MOGATs iced the broadcast network, the media link had been the communications system that kept the galaxy connected. When the Separatists destroyed the Mars broadcast disks, I assumed the media link system went with it. Trapped on Little Man, I never stopped to realize that most planets had their own media and their own local area media link networks. They might not be able to access the galaxy-wide network, but that did not mean they would abandon communications and programming on a local basis. I did not miss the movies or the music. You could keep the mail. I didn't have anyone to write to. What I missed was keeping up with current events. I missed the news. I sat on the edge of my bed staring at those shades, amazed at my excitement over such a simple thing. Finally, I slipped on the glasses. Little lasers projected interactive images onto the retinal tissue in my eyes. Using ocular commands, I sorted through menus until I found an all-news channel, then I lay back against my headboard and watched. The events of the day could not have been more mundane. With galactic communications shut down, I would only find local news. From what I could tell, life on Earth had not changed much since the broadcast network went down. The news analysts I saw never mentioned the war. They talked the economy to death. There was a lot of talk about sports and weather. No one so much as hinted that a top-secret alliance between the Unified Authority and its former enemies might be in the making. No one mentioned Shin Nippon or even the Confederate arms. I watched the news for 3 hours, then went to the mess for dinner. When I returned to my room, I sat on my bed and slipped on the shades. Sometime after midnight, I fell asleep. The alert came from the communications console beside my bed, waking me out of a restless sleep.
Colonel Harris, how are you this morning? I believe you served briefly under my command some years back.
Vice Admiral Alden Brocious commanded the Central Cygnus Fleet.
Colonel, I was wondering if you would join me for breakfast this morning.
Thank you, sir. Do you want to meet in the officer's mess?
That won't be necessary. I know a little place near Annapolis that might be just right.
It took me 2 minutes to run a razor over my stubble and sterile light my teeth. I did not worry about brushing my hair. As a veteran of the military orphanage system, I considered a crew cut the height of fashion, and I was always in fashion. The only fresh clothes I had was a colonel's uniform. I dressed and left. A limousine idled outside the door of the barracks. As I approached, a driver in a petty officer's uniform climbed out of the car, opened a door at the back of the car, then saluted. I returned the salute and climbed into the car.
Glad you could make it.
I'm not familiar with the protocol. Am I supposed to salute the chauffeur before entering the limousine?
You should if you're on active duty, but you're not on active duty yet.
I get the feeling I may be recalled.
Would you like to return to active duty?
I hadn't thought about it.
I asked around. If you came back, you might not be able to re-enter as a colonel. That was never official, you know. Admiral Huang sort of muscled that last promotion of yours through for security purposes. We might be able to preserve your officer status.
I'm happy as a civilian, sir.
How do you see the war going?
Sir?
What can we do to win this one, Harris?
The Mogats won't engage in a surface war. They're not that dumb. So you're going to need a self-broadcasting fleet if you want to engage them.
Do you think we have time to build another self-broadcasting fleet?
That depends how long it would take to build it. I've been out of the loop, sir. I only know what you and the Japanese have told me. From what I hear, time might be short. I don't see the Mogats waiting around forever. I mean, 3 years.
3 years?
We built the Galactic Central Fleet in 3 years.
Yeah, yes, we did. But we had the network up and running back then. Without the network, we can't send unfinished ships between dry docks. We'll have to start and complete each ship in the same facility. We're not looking at 3 years this time. We're looking at 10, if we get lucky. Maybe 12 if things don't fall into place.
We drove out of town and through a wooded countryside. Finally, we ended up in a residential area. To me, the mansions along the street looked as big as hotels. They had manicured lawns and acre-long driveways. We pulled up to a three-story home with a red brick facade and brown tile roof.
Nice place. Your home?
Not very often. My home is the fleet. I guess that makes this more my vacation house. When I'm in town on business, I generally stay in the barracks. It's much more convenient.
The car stopped in front of a red brick walkway that led to the door. Our chauffeur came around and opened the admiral's door.
The place has been in the family for generations. I make it out here 2, maybe 3 times a year.
We went inside. Whoever had decorated Admiral Brocious's home could not decide whether to go modern or antique. The entry had bright lights and shiny, smooth walls made out of a modern stone and glass hybrid. The builders had made curved corners and pleated the walls. The look was chic, I suppose. Beyond the entryway, the glass stone material gave way to cherry wood walls, leather furniture, and lots of bookcases. The house had a musty feeling. We entered a parlor decorated with antique brass instruments. The room had a telescope on a large hutch and a compass the size of a coffee table in the center of the floor. Brocious had an ancient map of some Earth ocean framed on the wall. We moved on to Brocious's private study. In this room, he had an antique roll-top desk. A painting of an old-time sailing ship cutting through a stormy sea hung on the wall. In one corner of the room stood a cutaway model of an early orbital space station.
What do you think?
It's comfortable.
I'll tell you a secret. I hate this room. As an admiral, I'm obligated to have at least one room like that in my house. We're all supposed to love the sea. We're supposed to be fascinated by the history of navigation. That's our public image. We have to decorate our houses to look like monuments to naval history.
Brocious led me upstairs. The staircase ended in an enormous parlor. When he turned on the lights, I saw mirrored walls, old-fashioned neon signs, and bulbs that blinked on and off. He had two rows of antique slot machines, the oldest of which took coins instead of credits. Some even had mechanical wheels with symbols instead of computer screens. In one corner of the room was a 20-foot display that looked like a track for horse racing. It had six tin horses on a mural that depicted a straightaway. There was a betting counter beside the game with six stools. It was impressive.
What do you think?
I like it.
It all works. Even the horse racing game. Some of these machines are over 500 years old.
Brocious pointed to three pinball machines against the far wall.
Those machines are American 20th century.
This room is a gambling man's dream. You must be quite a player.
Well, you've got me all wrong, Harris. I don't gamble. I win. The gamblers are the people who put money in my machines. Once in a while, they walk off with more than they brought. Usually, they leave empty-handed. Me? I always walk away with more than I started with. I'm the house. I get better odds.
We ate in a large dining room on a hardwood table that could have served 20 people. A petty officer in a dress uniform served us our meal. The man looked so serious as he handed us our plates, you would have thought Brocious had threatened him with a court-martial.
Did you know that the Mogats routed one of the fleets in the Perseus Arm?
One of our fleets?
Fortunately for us, they only sent a few ships. Our ships didn't put up much of a fight. Some outer Perseus ships overtook five Mogat ships as they broadcasted in an area they were patrolling. That's it, just five ships. Good thing. If there'd been more of them, we might have lost the whole damn fleet. The outer Perseus fleet is Adam Porter's outfit, mind you. Porter served on one of my ships a couple of years before he got his star. He's no Adam Splitter, that one. He never had much of a mind for strategy.
You called it a rout. How bad was it?
Porter went after them with a fighter carrier, five battleships, 10 frigates.
Beat by five Mogat ships?
Porter's fleet has the oldest ships in the galaxy. We're talking about the Perseus Arm, Harris. Nothing much happens out there. Before the war broke out, Congress wanted to shut the outer Perseus fleet down.
What kind of ships did the Mogats bring to the fight?
Five battleships. We've built our strategy around the idea that ship per ship, we can beat the Mogats any time. Now we have to rethink that. By the time they were done, Porter lost a fighter carrier and three battleships. The Mogats didn't even bother with his frigates.
What did they lose?
We don't know how much damage Porter did to the ships that got away, but he only sank one of their battleships. Porter is still in command of the fleet for now, but his career is specked. There's no room in the UA Navy for officers who let their fleet get chased by five ships.
So the Mogats sank a few of his ships. Then what? They wouldn't just let him leave.
That is precisely what they did.
Why the spec would they do that? Have there been any other engagements?
No.
Before they merged with the Confederate Arms and Halverson took over, the Mogats never seemed very bright.
Did you know Halverson's been promoted to Fleet Admiral? Our Fleet Admiral?
Admiral Tom Halverson, who led the attack on the Earth Fleet, joined the Confederate Arms while they were allied with the Atkins Believers. He left the Unified Authority as a Rear Admiral, received a few additional stars, and emerged as the head of the combined Mogat Confederate Arms Navy. The notion that Halverson could return and take command of our fleet clawed at my stomach.
I'll ask it again, Harris. What do we need? How do we stack the deck? What do we need to do to give ourselves house odds?
They're hard to read. I always knew that the Mogats were not military-minded, but allowing a fleet to escape is strange, even by their standards. They almost act surprised when they win. I mean, when they beat the Earth fleet and shut down the network, the planet was theirs. They should have landed troops and taken DC. Now you tell me that they had a fleet at their mercy and let it escape. It's almost like they want to convert us, not beat us.
Did you hear that they tried to land a Messiah in Israel?
Yes, I heard about the space Bibles, too.
I agree with you. It does sound like they're out to convert us.
We need one of their ships with its navigational computer in one piece. That is how we can find them.
We can send a salvage team to the battleship Porter sank.
No, we need a boat in working condition.
Capture a battleship? That would be a trick.
We have people who could do it. Can you get me to the outer Scutum Crux fleet?
Why Scutum Crux?
Because the Kamehameha is in that fleet.
In the entire Unified Authority Navy, there was only one expansion-class fighter carrier active in any of its fleets, the Kamehameha. All of the other carriers were of the more modern Perseus-class variety. They were 5,100 feet wide and carried 11,000 troops, 14 battalions of Marines just spoiling for a fight. The Kamehameha measured half that size and carried a mere 1,000 combat men, but they were special. They were Navy SEALs, and more than that, they were Adam Boyd clones. The Kamehameha might have been undersized and obsolete, but with that complement of Boyd clones, it could win a war. Larger than any battleship and smaller than other fighter carriers, the Kamehameha traveled with the rest of the Scutum Crux fleet as well hidden as a shark among dolphins. From the cabin of the self-broadcasting Explorer ship, I watched the whole fleet and remembered my days as a Marine. I spent almost 2 years on the Kamehameha, back when it carried Marines. I reported in as a corporal and transferred out as a lieutenant. On the charts and simulations, you always see ships laid out in a flat formation, even when the charts are three-dimensional. Coming in this time, I was struck by the way the fleet had grouped. The fighter carriers were in the center of a three-dimensional diamond, with layers of destroyers and battleships surrounding them from above, from below, and from every side. A trio of battleships led the formation. All of the ships had the same beige hull and light gray underbelly. Lights on the outsides of these ships illuminated their numbers and bows. The Unified Authority Navy placed little stock on stealth when it came to its fleets. As we circled around the back of the fleet, I watched the blue-white flames that flared from the ship's engines.
We've been cleared for approach, Colonel.
My pilot was a natural-born lieutenant, who seemed to resent playing chauffeur for a clone. Brocious cut me orders, too, but they were purposely vague. They identified me as being on Central Cygnus fleet business and told people to cooperate with me, and nothing more. Brocious's orders gave me enough leeway to land myself in the brig for life. They gave Brocious enough wiggle room to say I had acted on my own. My mind wandered as I sat alone. I was the only passenger in a cabin designed to hold 200 scientists. The Explorer was the size of an atmosphere-bound commercial jetliner, too big to fit in the Kamehameha's launch bay. We had to fly within a mile of the fighter carrier and match her speed. From where I sat, it looked like both ships had come to a stop. The Kamehameha sent out a 10-man skiff to meet us. The skiff mated with the Explorer, sealing its temporary airlock over our hatch like a tick attaching itself to a dog. Once the airlock was ready and the gangway was set, I crossed over and rode the skiff to the Kamehameha. As the hatch of the skiff opened and I stepped out onto the deck, I saw recognition on a few of the faces that waited to greet me. Some of these men had served on this ship 4 years ago, when I returned with six other survivors from the battle on Little Man. I saluted the captain, and he returned my salute. I was still dressed in the colonel's uniform I had worn to breakfast at Brocious's house. Technically, I was impersonating an officer, but the uniform was the only clothing I had at the moment.
Requesting permission to come aboard?
Welcome aboard.
Thank you, sir. May I present my orders to the captain?
Let's see your orders, Colonel.
I handed him the sheet.
You wish to meet with my SEALs. I don't suppose you're able to tell me what you might discuss with them.
I said nothing and looked straight ahead.
I didn't think so. Ensign, conduct Colonel Harris down to the barracks. See that he meets Ilyich.
I saluted. The captain saluted. His salute seemed more formal than it had a few moments earlier. The ensign led me out of the launch bay and down the corridor. I could not get over the feeling of deja vu as we walked the halls. Oh, the layout had been changed a bit, and the clones did not look like the clones with whom I served, but I still recognized the rec room and mess hall. When we passed by the door to my former barracks, I wanted to stop and peer in. Finally, the ensign delivered me to a small briefing room. The SEAL who came to the door and saluted us wore a star and three red stripes on his arm. That made him a Master Chief Petty Officer. He had gone as far as he could go in the non-commissioned ranks. In the world of cloned SEALs, this man was the ultimate authority.
Colonel Harris, this is Ilyich. He pretty much runs things down here.
This was the first time I had seen a Boyd clone so close without fighting him. I had not realized exactly how ugly they would be. He had a small mouth and almost no lips. A thick ridge of bone ran along the tops of his eye sockets. That ridge would offer protection in hand-to-hand combat. I knew from experience that it made them hell with a headbutt. I stood 10 inches taller than Ilyich. Looking down and trying to hide my nervousness, I returned his salute. I had seen the Boyd clones in action. They killed without hesitation.
Ilyich?
Colonel?
Ensign. Perhaps Mr. Ilyich and I could have a word?
The ensign saluted, turned, and left us. We both took a seat at the table.
Is there something on your mind, Chief?
You're a Liberator clone.
Nothing gets past you Boyd clones.
You know, Colonel, Admiral Huang always referred to us as Special Operations Clones. We were never called Adam Boyd clones. There was a clone from our outfit who went by the name Adam Boyd, but the official term was Special Operations Clone. Interesting thing about Adam Boyd, Colonel. He was killed in a tough man competition on an Earth island called Oahu. That was our original base of operations. Have you ever been to the Hawaiian Islands?
As a matter of fact, I have.
So you've been to Hawaii, sir. May I ask, is that where you got that scar over your eye?
That is correct.
A swimming accident?
Not swimming.
Rock climbing, then?
Not exactly. I was at a place called Sad Sam's Palace.
I've heard of the place. Don't they hold tough man competitions there on Friday nights?
Yes, they do. As it turns out, I was there on a Friday night. I went to watch the fights, but I got suckered into entering.
The petty officer sat still and silent for several seconds, his strange grin unchanged as he studied me. I could not tell what went through his mind. For all I knew, he had been in the audience watching as I beat his brother clone to death. Time passed as we sat and regarded each other, neither of us wanting to be the one to end the silence. I pulled out the orders Admiral Brocious had given me and slid them across the table. Without saying a word, Ilyich picked them up and read them to himself. Still grinning, he looked up again.
Got anything exciting in mind, sir?
Space is not black. Looking into a night sky or staring out the portholes of some large starship, it's easy to think that outer space is black. It's not black, it's clear. It is so wide and immense and open that it seems to crowd around you, but only because the human mind cannot comprehend the length of a single light year, let alone 100,000 light years. An enemy ship could easily hide in the vastness of space. With their charcoal-colored hulls, Mogat ships could slip into an empty pocket of space and vanish. I took a team of SEALs with me to view the battlefield where the Mogats had made short work of the Outer Perseus fleet. Inside the Explorer, an unarmed vessel, the SEALs had a good reason to feel nervous. Designed for scientific expeditions, the Explorer's top speed was under 10 million miles per hour. Its broadcast engine needed a full 20 minutes to recharge between broadcasts. Mogat battleships and cruisers had a top speed of 30 million miles per hour. They could charge their broadcast engines in 8 minutes. If the Mogats spotted us, they could outrun and outshoot us. If it came to a battle, we might as well have been flying in a coffin. Considering the number of ships Admiral Porter lost, his battle with the Mogats took place on a relatively condensed field. A swarm of dead fighters floated in a tight formation around our ship. Looking from the deck of a battleship or a fighter carrier, the dead fighters might have looked like the carcasses of insects caught in an old spider web. Looking through the window of a small explorer with no armor and no shields, the broken ships looked ominous. Our explorer might have been 5 times the size of those fighters. They did not look so small from where I now sat. Bigger wrecks loomed in the distance. No lights showed through their portholes, and their observation decks were dark. We passed within a couple hundred feet of a UA fighter carrier. I could see its fatal wounds. 10-foot-wide holes dotted the front section of its bow. The big ship hung motionless.
They're like ghosts.
Ilyich looked tense as he checked and rechecked his gear.
Pardon me, sir, but what are we looking for out here?
The man who approached me had scars around his mouth and nose. Several white lines streaked his lips and faded into his chin. All of the Boyds bore scars. They were inevitable when you did not wear armor in battle.
Sir, what are we looking for on the Mogat ship?
I want their broadcast computer for openers. If we can figure out where their ships have been, we might be able to drop in on the Mogat's home base.
Colonel Harris.
Have you got something?
We found their ship.
I'm on my way.
I turned to Ilyich.
You want to come up?
He nodded. One of the chief uses of this particular ship was space cartography. It had an all-glass cockpit. Looking at the view from the cockpit felt like floating in space. The only light in the pilot's area came from the low glow of the instrumentation.
It's that one over there.
The Explorer moved very slowly past the wreckage of a Tomcat, nudging the crumpled fuselage out of its way. Off to the right, I saw the target. At first, it looked more like a shadow than a battleship. It was a black hole in the middle of a field of stars. Then I recognized the shape, the bulbous bow and the wide diamond hull. I did not actually see the ship. I saw the shape of its silhouette against a backdrop of stars.
How do we get in?
That's your problem. My job is to bring you here. I've done my part.
We look for an open door.
I thought you would say something along those lines.
We went back to the cargo hold and put on our helmets. The SEALs wore armor made specifically for them. My armor was green. Their armor had smart camouflage. As they maneuvered, sensors in their helmets would read the color and lighting in the environment, changing the color of their suits. We stepped onto the cargo elevator at the very back of the ship. It lifted us into an airlock in the roof, where we boarded a 10-man space sled. There were only 7 of us, and the SEALs were small. It might have held 12 of them.
You ready, Colonel? Open the locks.
The metal dome that covered the airlock peeled back slowly to reveal the stars behind it. I hit the release button to retract the sleeves that clamped our sled in place. The sled dislodged from the Explorer and lifted into open space. Normally, we would attach jetpacks to our armor before traversing open space. We did not on this occasion. Once we entered the derelict battleship, we would likely enter unstable areas with radiation and chemical contamination. Who could predict what we would find on that ship? We could not risk wearing jetpacks. We had 0.5 mile to traverse between the Explorer and the battleship. As we covered the distance, some of the Boyd clones played their search beams along the hull of the derelict ship. The hull looked smooth and untouched from what I could see.
It doesn't look like there are any open doors on the top side, sir.
Not that I can see. Not that I can see.
Something else was missing. Not only did I not see any breaks in the hull, I did not see scorch marks. That part of the battleship looked pristine, as if it had never been hit. We flew over the top of the diamond-shaped hull. Because of the curve of its fuselage, the battleship's bulky wings seemed to dissolve into space. We flew over the bridge. On a ship like this, the bridge more closely resembled government offices than the wheelhouses of the old seafaring ships. There was no wheel. The navigation was handled by a set of computers. Looking into the viewport of this wreck as we flew by, I saw nothing but darkness. We dropped down the front edge of the ship. We had just flown across its topside, and now we dropped down to examine its underbelly.
What happened here?
An enormous gash ran half the length of the ship. It almost looked as if some giant had grabbed the battleship by its wings, stabbed a knife into its underside, then slashed it across its belly.
Shit. Someone specked them over bad.
As we dropped under the battleship, its keel extended over us like a pitch-black sky. The breach across it looked like a gigantic crater. 4 of the SEALs played their lights across it, exposing a 40-foot-wide gash through which a careful pilot might successfully fly a small ship. From the look of things, the outer shell around these wounds had simply melted away. Bubbles, some popped and some whole, pocked the blackened edges of the gash. As we flew toward the opening, one of the SEALs shined his light directly into it, illuminating the ship's skeletal girders. The light uncovered torn wires and something that I first thought might be a ladder and later realized was the aluminum framing between the ceiling of one deck and the floor of the next. The gash through the hull extended up 3 decks of the ship.
There's our open door.
I steered the sled into the gash. As we rose into that gash, several engines burst on and off as I fine-tuned the ascent to avoid jagged edges and debris.
Stop!
The sled did not stop on a dime, but it stopped quickly enough.
You're not going to believe this, but I'm picking up security sensors.
Active sensors?
That's what I'm reading. They're ancient, and I mean ancient. Electronic motion tracking sensors.
The ship is 50 years old.
At first I thought the reconnaissance armor contained technology that my combat armor lacked. All 6 SEALs stood huddled together, staring straight up like bird watchers trying to spot some rare species. Then I saw that each held some sort of remote in their hands.
Think we can jam it? No problem.
The SEAL held up the remote, something the size of a deck of cards, with a row of buttons across it. He pressed one of the buttons. The button lit up red.
Nice spotting.
Ilyich turned to me.
You won't have one of these stealth kits, sir. Stay with me. As long as you're with one of us, the sensors won't detect you.
Is it safe to enter?
Yes, sir, Colonel. If you have one of these stealth kits, you can skip rope, pass gas, and cook cheeseburgers all at the same time, and the sensors won't spot you.
Rising through the wreckage, we passed 2 decks and stopped on the 3rd. Whatever Porter and his fleet had fired at the battleship took out every system. I saw no signs of working electricity. The artificial gravity was out. The life support was down.
You seen anybody? I expected dead sailors floating around.
Think they evacuated the ship?
Don't count on it. Anybody in this area would have gotten flushed out.
So you think we'll find bodies?
Sure we will. Over 1,000 of them if this battleship had a full crew. You and your boys aren't squeamish.
I landed the sled on the first solid stretch of floor I found.
All right, let's split up.
What did you have in mind, sir?
I sent 5 of the SEALs to the bridge to examine the navigation computer and whatever charts they could find.
Why don't you come with me to the engineering section?
Ilyich saluted and followed. Before leaving the Kamehameha, we preloaded the general deck map of a GCF battleship into our helmet computers. The maps were based on 50-year-old information, but they proved reliable.
What's in engineering?
We pulled our way across the deck. With no gravity to hold us down, it was easier to float than walk. We sprang from bulkheads and pulled ourselves along walls.
The broadcast engine for openers.
Do you have any idea what could have cut through a ship like that?
It had to be a laser. Did you see the damage on the outside of the ship? The plating around the edges melted. Particle beams blow things apart. Lasers cook their way through.
But this, it must have been some kind of new laser.
From what Admiral Brocious told me, the Outer Perseus fleet doesn't have anything new, just hand-me-downs. If you had some miracle laser, would you waste it out here?
We headed down a corridor. Through the night-for-day lens in my visor, I saw the hallway ahead of us in blue, white, and black. It was as smooth and as featureless as a sheath for a sword. The walls, ceilings, and floor were entirely untouched. There had probably been people in this area of the ship when the laser breached the hull. There may once have been bodies, chairs, and equipment around the hull, but all of that would have been flushed out along with the oxygen. The corridor ahead of us was chillingly immaculate.
If they just had a run-of-the-mill laser, how did they make that hole?
Simple. Someone on board this ship must have shut down the shields.
Why would somebody lower the shields? That would be suicide.
I'm only guessing here. I think one of their officers committed suicide and took the ship with him. This would not be the first time the MOGAT sent a crew on a kamikaze mission.
You believe that the entire crew of this ship willingly committed suicide? That would have been hundreds of men.
You wouldn't need a kamikaze crew, just one man. Once the guy controlling the shields turns off the power, it doesn't matter what the rest of the crew believes.
But they were winning the battle when the ship went down. They could have had the whole damn fleet on a platter.
Yeah.
I was wondering why the MOGATs would purposely lose a battle. A saboteur, maybe? But that did not fit. UA intelligence had not penetrated the MOGAT military. For some reason, the MOGATs had apparently sacrificed the ship and the battle. We came to a companionway that ran between decks. Peering through a window, I looked into the shaft.
There might be air in here.
Air in the shaft would present a hazard. The pressure from that air would send everything flying out at us the moment we cracked the hatch.
May I have a try, sir?
I pushed away from the hatch. Ilyich replaced his particle beam pistol in his belt and pulled out a tiny laser torch. Ilyich aimed his laser at the hatch and bored a pinprick hole. First the red dot appeared, then the beam intensified. The material of the door bubbled and melted away. Had there been oxygen in the stairwell, it would have leaked through the hole. Nothing happened.
Looks like it's safe, sir.
Can you remove the hatch?
Yes, sir.
He slowly traced across the hinges. A minute later, he gave the hatch a tug and it drifted out of our way. Kicking off the walls, we dropped down the open companionway to a lower deck. Below me, looking more like deformed marble statues than human beings, were the bodies of 3 dead sailors. I passed over them and entered the vast cavern of the engine room.
Colonel, we may have a problem.
What is it, Ilyich?
I just got a call from the guys on the bridge. One of their stealth kits failed.
Did the sensor spot them?
Yes, sir. Whether or not someone was watching is another question. They say they switched to a different kit quickly.
I better radio the pilot and have him keep an eye out for visitors.
I did so, then went back to exploring the engine room. The dead men inside the engine room were not dressed in pressure suits or space gear. When the laser sheared through the hull and the vacuum of space replaced their pressurized atmosphere, the blood pressure in their bodies burst through their skins. Blood vessels, veins, eyes, and skin all popped like balloons. The basic shapes of the men sprawled along the floor looked human enough, but it looked like someone had tried to peel their faces from their heads. The engine room itself lay in ruins. Some of the equipment must have exploded before the air ran out. I saw scorch marks on the walls, and a few of the bodies bore signs of incineration. Looking around the room, I saw overturned desks and smashed computers. There was not so much as a working console in the entire vast cavern. Even the emergency lights in this morgue were dead.
What happened in here?
Colonel, back here.
Ilyich headed toward the back of the engine room. As I followed, I saw an odd flickering glow that shone on the walls and furniture. I almost missed the subtle light changes surveying the room through my night-for-day lens. Switching to my standard tactical lens, I saw the blue-white glow of an electrical arc. It looked as if someone might have been using a spot welder around the corner.
What do you think of this? How do you think it survived when everything else got blown up?
Peering slowly around the corner, my pistol drawn, I saw a second broadcast engine. It did not have the 30-foot-high brass cylinders of the battleship's main broadcast engine. It was smaller and tucked away at the back of the ship. The 18 cylinders in this engine were about 8 feet tall and connected together by a web of cables as thick as my arms. Across the top of the cylinders, jagged lines of electricity danced from joint to joint.
That's not possible.
I started toward the engine for a closer look, but Ilyich pulled me back.
No, I wouldn't do that. There may be a shield around it.
I inched slightly closer, but did not see the telltale glimmer of an electrical field.
Colonel, they're coming!
Bogat?
Who the spec cares? I've got to get out of here!
Where are they?
They just broadcast it in. I picked up the anomaly.
I'm going to need a couple of minutes.
I don't have minutes. I don't have seconds.
Everybody back to the sled.
I pushed off against the railing and bounded back toward the companionway.
Colonel, what is it?
Mogat.
In the ship?
Outside. The pilot picked them up on radar. What's happening out there?
Two ships coming in quick. I can't wait for you. I need...
You can't outrun them. Find some place to hide and play dead.
I gotta get out of here!
You can't... Explorer, come in! Explorer, come in!
Shit! Sir?
We just lost our specking ride.
On our way to the engine room, Ilyich and I passed a room with a broad window looking out into space. I headed toward the room.
Ilyich, have your team meet us here.
There was no reason to head for the space sled anymore. Our explorer was gone.
Regroup on my mark.
Ilyich's men responded without comment. I went to the glass wall and stared out, not knowing what I hoped to find. In the back of my mind, I guess I expected to see the smoldering wreckage of the Explorer. It was nowhere to be found, of course. In the seconds that I spoke with the pilot, he might have flown 10,000 miles.
You see anything out there, sir?
I did. Just for a moment, I saw a black shadow that got between our ship and the stars. It moved quickly, and I lost track of it, but it was out there.
How the spec can they know that we're here?
The signals from the security sensors should not have traveled faster than the speed of light. Could it even have traveled 100 million miles in the few moments we had been on board the ship? Yet the Mogat ships had broadcasted in. That meant they had come from a long way away. They would have had to have been close to receive the signal, but they should not have needed to broadcast in if they were close enough to receive it. How far could they go and still hear their burglar alarm? My mind flashed on the working broadcast engine we'd seen in the engineering section.
There is no way that broadcast engine could have survived. The room is a disaster.
The other SEALs entered the room.
The Mogats shot down our ride. They shot down our specking ride.
We've got company.
I turned and looked. Two Mogat transports floated in our direction, their naked steel hulls appearing flat gray in the darkness. I had a particle beam pistol. We all had particle beam pistols. That was the general issue weapon for combat in non-atmospheric situations. Each of the approaching transports could carry a complement of 100 Mogat commandos. The way I saw it, we had two options. Our best bet was to hide. Using those stealth kits, we could move undetected by their sensors. The only other option was to attack the Mogats as they stepped off their transports. The SEALs came up with a better option.
I always heard that you Liberator clones were lucky.
What do you mean?
Listen to this.
The SEAL patched me into the frequency he was listening to over the interlink.
Okay. So we break up into 8 groups. The sensors only picked them up for a second. They were on the bridge.
You tapped the Mogat's communications.
All of their equipment is stuff they stole from us. I just did a frequency scan, and there they were.
Ilyich had one of his SEALs give me his stealth kit. He teamed that man up with another SEAL and sent them out. He sent his other 3 SEALs out on their own. They scattered around the ship. The 2-man team headed for the bow. One of the lone SEALs returned to the engine room. Another went to the top deck. The last man went midship. When the time came, they would lead the Mogats on a wild goose chase. They would do it one at a time, jamming and unjamming the security sensors in such a way that there only appeared to be one intruder on the ship. I had no doubt about the SEAL's ability to pull off this trick. Using Ilyich's stealth kit to neutralize the motion sensors, he and I stole to a corridor that reached all the way across the ship. The corridor ran along the lowest deck. When the laser had hit the belly of this battleship, it carved out huge sections of the floor and walls. I listened to the Mogats blunder through their maneuvers as we went. One of their teams had a sergeant barking out orders which, from the sound of things, no one understood. The more he screamed, the more confused his men became. The old battleship was 2/3 of a mile wide and just under 1/2 mile long from bow to stern. We did not tire flying through the corridor. Our feet never even touched the deck. At midship, we reached a 50-foot stretch of corridor below which the entire hull had been sheared away during the battle. All that was left of it was the right-hand wall and ceiling. Everything else was wreckage and stars. Seen through the night-for-day lens in my visor, Space looked flat and black with a swirl of blue-white specks. Then I pushed off the wall and over through the missing section of corridor, focusing my attention on the floor ahead. Ilyich followed.
Delta team, check the lower deck main corridor.
That placed one of the MOGAT teams on the same deck as Ilyich and I, probably no less than two walls away. If they came into our hall before we reached the other side of the gap, we would have no place to hide and little chance of defending ourselves. It didn't happen that way. The MOGATs preferred the safety of corridors with all four walls intact. From listening to their communications, I could tell that the MOGAT commandos did not believe anyone had trespassed onto the ship. They thought the alarm was proof of a malfunctioning sensor.
We better show them some bait before they lose interest.
Team Alpha, go ahead and bait the trap.
Yes, sir!
Got him! I got him!
Ilyich led the way as we continued across the ship.
Do you have any idea how much of the ship is wired for motion?
Every inch of it, from what I can tell.
Good thing your boy looked for sensor fields.
Near the front of the ship, we crossed a major corridor that ran from one wing of the ship to the other. This hall was so wide, you could drive two tanks side by side across it. Ilyich traveled along the ceiling. I hung low, an inch above the floor. We saw no signs of damage. Here the ship looked dormant, not derelict. I saw no debris, though I did see dead sailors when I peered into the hatches.
How did they get into the launch bay? There shouldn't be any power in the doors.
Maybe the atmospheric locks were open.
Ilyich, your ship is under attack, and you're going to send out unarmed transports?
Maybe the locks opened when the battleship blew up?
Yeah, sure. And all MOGAT ships carry pint-sized broadcast engines along as a spare. When the MOGATs sacrificed this ship, they had something up their sleeve.
We moved ahead. I continued to listen to the MOGATs, leaving Ilyich to figure out our course.
Stop.
I listened in on the MOGAT communication.
No, wait! There they are! They're near the engine room! These guys are fast! Get down there! Don't let them get anywhere near the broadcast engine!
Ilyich contacted his team.
You hear that? Stay away from the engine room. Lead them back to midship.
Up ahead, a squad of soldiers crossed the hall. They had not adjusted to the lack of gravity and tried to move along the floor as if in a ship with gravity and an atmosphere. We slid gracefully above the deck. They waddled and bounced with every step. There were eight men, all carrying lasers in one hand and searchlights in the other. Had they shined their lights in our direction, they could easily have spotted us. But not a one of them even paused to make certain the path was clear before crossing.
Pathetic. Didn't anyone ever teach them to look both ways before crossing? We should have picked them off just on principle. What do these MOGATs teach their boys in basic knitting? I cannot believe they are winning this war.
Are you always this chatty on stealth missions?
Is that a rhetorical question, sir?